And good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. Well, my name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you listening. This morning in this hour of Focus, we are pleased to have as our guest Tommy Shelby. He is professor of African and African American Studies and Philosophy at Harvard University. He's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving the annual philosophy lecture on the topic Justice, Self-Respect, and the Culture of Poverty. That's this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4. And anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. This is also an event in the MillerCom series. And in some of his writing, he has said, historically, political unity among black Americans has contributed a lot to the cause of social justice in this country. But in a time that some people have argued race doesn't mean anything anymore, the question is, does black solidarity still have a purpose? Can black political unity help bring us closer to a world where justice prevails, particularly for America's most disadvantaged citizens? These are some of the themes that he explores in his work and his writing. He is the author of the book We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity, and also co-editor of the book Hip Hop and Philosophy, Rhyme to Reason, and many other publications as well. And we're very pleased that he could be here, spend some time with us in the studio, and we'll be talking. Questions are also welcome from people who are listening. So if you'd like to join and direct the conversation a little bit, you certainly can do that. 333-9455. That's the number for folks who are in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, for you. That's 800-222-9455. And the email, you can also share your thoughts that way, will-talk. Well, that's willtalk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I realize this is starting with the frame awfully big, but I will. And so here's what I'm thinking here. So here we are now. It's the year 2012. And not only are we in the post-civil rights era, we're in the post-post-civil rights era. Yeah. And this country has elected a black president. And if we didn't understand how important that is, the rest of the world sure did. So on the one hand, we would have to say this country has changed fundamentally, certainly, say, since the end of World War II. But at the same time, we have significant issues around race in this country, no doubt about it, and we have significant numbers of African Americans who are living in poverty and are among some of our most disadvantaged citizens, living concentrated in some of the big cities of this country. And that's something that we've been wrestling with that for decades. Why have we not been able to make any progress on that?
Well, it's a very difficult and challenging problem, I think. I mean, in a lot of ways, I am influenced by my colleague, the distinguished sociologist William Julius Wilson. And, you know, over a 40-year career, he's been wrestling with these sorts of issues, trying to understand, you know, why even in at least the post-civil rights era, we find ourselves still faced with these poor urban communities and where, you know, a third of the black population is living in rather severe, severely disadvantaged conditions. You know, and he points to quite a wide range of factors. I don't think there's sort of like one thing that accounts for it. I mean, it has to, he would emphasize things of you know, just at the point where the real gains of the civil rights movement were had, you get a complete shift in the economy away from manufacturing toward a more service-based economy. There's globalization and there's competition amongst low-skilled workers around the world, and so in some ways it's these two things come together. So you get a number of blacks who have access to good education and are able to do quite well for themselves. But then there are a number of others who lack the education and who lack certain skills and find themselves in a tough spot in our current economy. But of course, there are many other factors that explain it. But I would emphasize it's probably the complexity of it. That there's no, you can't just pass a law and it'll all go away.
Well, and it certainly there has been no shortage of time spent and thought invested by government, by academics, by journalists in thinking about this and at least suggesting solutions. Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem that all of those people are really outside of where the core of the problem is, and that the people who are most affected seem really not to have much of a voice. I mean, they're in politics. They're the people who have the least voice, and it seems that the lowest ability to actually be at the table and be in the conversation.
Yes, I'm sure that's a big part of the issue. There's since the Johnson administration, in a way, there's been a move to try to deal with problems of poverty with complex social problems that are defended and introduced by social scientists who, you know, give complex reasons for thinking that a certain sort of intervention would be helpful. And there's a tendency toward a kind of, you know, social engineering model for thinking about how to fix the problem, which is not really a bottom-up, let's have a conversation about how we might solve it, but more of a reliance on experts, economists and sociologists and political scientists and others who think if you institute this particular set of incentives that you'll be able to solve it. And mostly that has not been a very, very effective way of going about it. Though I think there are some people in the liberal policy community who I think would emphasize the importance of being in dialogue with people in these communities, and indeed a lot of the current programs that are relied upon are not top-down government programs, but rather programs that come from various nonprofit organizations and community organizations that apply for money from the government to try to run programs they think will be helpful. So there are some signs that the message of just a top-down technocratic solution won't solve the problem.
Mm. Well, I guess I find myself going back to this to the thinking about the complexity of the problem here, and that depending on what your interest is or your discipline is or how you want to approach it, that it's, some people will say, well, really, this is really a fundamental, this is poverty issue, and it has to do with lack of jobs that pay a living wage that people can supply, take care of a family on. And some other people say, well, really, at the heart of it all is it's an education issue, and it's a bad schools problem, and it's a problem that people are, they don't have choice, and they go to the worst schools that we have in America. And then other people say, well, but you can't really ignore the fact that there's also a housing issue here, and that we still have discrimination in housing. And so if you don't have a choice about where you have to live, well, that really affects where you can work. It affects where your children can go to school. And then there are other people who say, well, no, really, the problem is here. We have, there's a lack of models of success that you can look to and say, oh, well, that person made it. Well, then that means I can make it. And then there are people who come along and say, well, but really, we still have a problem with discrimination, simple discrimination when it comes to race, and that's a big disadvantage just right out of the starting gate, not to mention a lot of other stuff. And if all that's true, and I think that all that is true, then really where do you even start?
Well, my inclination is to try to move away from framing it as a localized social problem that we need to figure out. Well, what are the causes of it, and then surgically intervene to remove the problem, but rather to step back a bit and ask some questions about the social structure that we all live in, and the rights and opportunities that we all claim as a matter of justice, and to think about whether, though our society there's opportunity for people to make make a lot of money and to do very well, it's also possible for people to be mired in really degrading forms of poverty, and to have a society that's sort of a winner-take-all competition for the spoils. And I think there are questions about whether that's a society we want to be support and to give our allegiance to, or whether we should be thinking about more fundamental questions about what social justice requires, what does it mean to have equal standing, equal civic standing in society, what are the material conditions for having equal standing in a society. And that changed the conversation a bit, so it's not just about, you know, here's a social problem and what the experts say about how we might intervene, but more a question about what kind of association do we want to be a part of, and can we think of our political and social association as a just one that merits our allegiance and support? So as a philosopher, since Plato's Republic, people have been thinking about the question about what justice requires, my inclination is to emphasize those questions over more technocratic solutions.
Well, now that's it. I sort of apologize for saying, well, I was going to start out with a big question, but now we're even getting into something that's even larger if we're questioning some very basic assumptions about what you can be, and we're going to question this whole idea that you can be anything that you want to be, and if you do, well, good for you, mm-hmm. and if not, well, you're just not trying hard enough. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to say that the idea of a just society it's much different than that, it's much different than that, then we're talking about social engineering, moving from one to the other. I'm not exactly sure how we do that.
Well, I'm not either, actually. I do think that our discussions about urban poverty should be take place in the context of these questions about social justice. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, philosopher can come down from the mountain and say, you know, here's what we should all do, or here's how you should think about justice, but those our public discussions should be framed that way. And there's a way in which, I mean, step away from the question of urban poverty and think about the healthcare discussion that we had a couple years ago. And it was rare to have that discussion framed as a matter of social justice. And it would have been interesting to see what would happen if that were the discussion. You know, is there a fundamental right to have access to basic health care? And if so, what bundle of services should each person have a claim to? And then we could think about the questions about, well, how would you pay for that? And if we think that everyone has this, and what's an equitable way of sharing the cost of providing? And that's a discussion that would have, I think, would have been nice to have. But we didn't really have a discussion of that of that sort. So my suggestion is that with a number of problems, the things that typically get framed as social problems, and we just ask the experts, well, how do we do it, and they come up with a very complicated answer, that we at least have some moments where we're, you know, as citizens thinking about, you know, what kind of society we want to live in, what entitlements do people have as a matter of justice, and it's not just a matter of us doing people a favor, but that they can lay claim to and have a right to complain about if they don't get those things. I think that would be a much, much more productive way to proceed.
Well, it strikes me is that we're really having an oddly of two minds on this, because I think on the one hand, there is generally an acceptance of the idea that there are some fundamental human rights of people to, you know, have safety and security in their homes and persons, and we do have at least some notion that people are entitled to a basic level of education and a basic level of housing and a basic diet and things like that. And I think that if you try to engage people in a conversation and ask them, well, do you really believe that that's true, that all those things are true, that there are certain kinds of entitlements? Mm-hmm. I think probably a lot of people would agree with that. But then when you start thinking about, well, how do we get there, mm-hmm. there doesn't seem to be the idea that somehow some effort is required. that some social program, that we have to say, well, not only do we believe in that, but let's talk about how we actually get there. Why is there that gap between people's accepting of the concept, but then they don't seem to understand, well, okay, then we actually have to have some deliberate effort to get to make that actually happen.
This is a longstanding conundrum. I mean, Martin Luther King would often emphasize in his speeches and writings how there are a number of Americans who can agree to certain basic principles of equality, and he doesn't doubt their conviction that he believes that in fact that they think these things are true. But the trouble comes is that to realize these principles, it may cost some people some things, and it may impose certain burdens on people that they would rather not accept if they can evade them. So I think that gap is that gap that's the hard one. It's the from, you know, commitment to the principle to the put your money where your mouth is. That's the hard part. And there are a number of people of affluent people who I think they really do believe that everyone should have a fair chance to live the kind of life that they want to live in this society. But when they think about what that might cost them, they're resistant because it might mean, for instance, that their kids need to be at a school with kids who are much more disadvantaged than their kids, or they might live in a neighborhood with people who are much more disadvantaged than they are, or that it might mean that their taxes are going to go up. And so on. So I think it's that gap that's the hard one to cross, and that's the kind of discussion we have to have. And again, with the case of healthcare, a lot of people have healthcare they're perfectly happy with, and they might be resistant because they know that perhaps it might cost them something to make sure that everybody has adequate healthcare.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Tommy Shelby. He's professor of African and African-American studies and philosophy at Harvard University. He's visiting our campus. He's going to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, and it's the annual philosophy lecture, Justice, Self-Respect, and the Culture of Poverty. That's the title they've given it. And he'll be talking this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. Anyone who is interested can stop by and hear what he has to say. And comments, questions, reaction to what some of the things that you've said so far, all that's possible. You can join the conversation very easily by calling us 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we also have an email you can use. That's will-talk, at illinois.edu. Here's a caller to bring in to the conversation. Champaign County, here where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I don't know where this post-civil rights language comes from. I don't want you to spend a lot of time talking about its origin, but we have, you know, Ron Paul and Tea Partyists who think that the Civil Rights Act is wrong and it's abridgment of states' rights. We have a fair minority in this country that believe that. So it's still contested ground. And speaking, walking while black is still dangerous in gated communities and other places in the inner city. The statistics on how many people get stopped. The fact that we don't have what looks like a civil rights movement doesn't mean that there aren't people working on prison issues all over this country, which is a racial issue. So I don't know where that comes from, and it's frustrating to hear it in some ways.
Well, can you want to? I was the one who used used those words. What's your thought about that?
Well, I mean, I would agree with the caller. I don't think it's helpful to think of ourselves as living in a kind of post-racial epoch when I use the language of post-civil rights, it's meant to as a way of periodizing in the civil rights movement, the main gains there, legislative gains there, is Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act, and so on, that and basically the dismantling of Jim Crow, which was these important, you know, achievements that made a huge difference in the lives of a lot of people, and especially a lot of black people. But I entirely agree with the caller that there's much to be concerned about in the racial arena. There's still a fair amount of discrimination and racial profiling, and obviously the problems of the criminal justice system loom large here that need to be addressed. So I have no disagreement on that question.
I mean, the Voters' Rights Act is being attacked through these subterfuges and the sponsorship by the ALEC. I don't know. It's just if we don't have a civil rights movement, we certainly need one, and I think we do. I just think it's coming in below the radar. There's a lot of activism here on police abuse and just incarceration, the books to prisoners projects and things like that.
Yes, I agree. I mean, there is a lot of that.
Sorry.
There is a lot of activism of that sort going on. There's a lot of activism going on the ground, and I think, though there are, you know, there's minority opinion about, you know, there are a few people who think that the Civil Rights Act is unjust, though there are a contingent, and there are reactionary forces that need to be struggled against. But some of what we're witnessing is bare knuckle politics, frankly. I mean, it has to do with a party wanting to gain control of the White House and greater control over Congress and a willingness to do whatever it will take to do that. And if that means demagoguery and drawing on racist attitudes and dog whistling and so on, then they do that. And, you know, my hope is that that's still a minority view that they're appealing to, even if it might turn out that it helps them create a coalition that whereby they can gain or regain power.
Mm. Well, I certainly wouldn't. I don't think anybody would argue that we don't have a problem with race in the United States now. And I think at the same time, some people would say, well, but, you know, there are fundamental ways in which this country is different than it was in, say, 1950. So how do you both acknowledge the fact that there has been change, positive change, and yet that we still have a very long way to go?
I think we should always do that. I mean, in a way, I think in some ways our president is good on this point. He often, in at least before he was elected, there are reasons for that. But before he was like, I mean, in his writings, in speeches, would, I think, do a good job of trying to explain the gains that we should all be proud of and also explain the problems that remain. And I guess I don't entirely understand why that's not a perfectly acceptable stance to take, that, you know, there has been progress. Important progress that a lot of people contributed to, of all races, and yet there are things that remain to be done, and that we should continue, you know, to push hard to realize full equalities, full equal civic standing for us all, and a fair opportunity structure for everyone. I don't understand why there's so much difficulty. I mean, I suppose that part of it has to do with a kind of, I don't know, weariness of the problem. People are tired of thinking about it, hearing about it. It's been, you know, it's a very long, long, been a very, very long struggle to try to solve the problems of race over many decades, even centuries. And it's natural for some people to feel like they'd rather not think about it anymore and would like to just believe, maybe in a wishful thinking kind of way, that we've solved all of that. Mm-hmm.
There's something that I'm interested also in having you talk a little bit about, and that's class. Mm-hmm. And I'm prompted to ask the question because I know that you're interested in Marxist theory Certainly, we have a country that is divided along lines of race, and it's also divided along class lines, although that's one of these things that we just don't really like to talk about. And I don't know if it's we don't know how, or we just simply are deluding ourselves and we like to believe that there is no such thing. How does class enter into this? And because I know that there are some people who have said, this is also very important. It may be as important. Some people might even make the argument that it's more important than race as a divider. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's very difficult to separate the problems of race from problems of class. It's one of the things that sort of defines American politics is the ways in which those two sets of problems interact. I mean, to give one sort of concrete example, you might think in a society like ours that solidarity amongst working class blacks, Latinos, and whites would be an easy thing to happen, but it doesn't. And in fact, many members of the white working class support the Republican Party. They are skeptical of unions. I mean, not all, of course, but some are. And there isn't, and nor has there ever been, a really robust interracial working class movement that captured the vast majority of the white of the working class in this country. So it's very hard for me to separate the two. But yes, I would certainly agree that in many ways, in terms of what the more urgent, I would even say, I wouldn't say more necessarily more morally important, but maybe the more urgent set of questions do have to do with economic inequality and inequality of opportunity. And that even if there was a focus on providing those kinds of opportunities for the least advantaged, regardless of race, it would do a lot of good for disadvantaged racial minorities. I mean, I'm not a person who believes that we should therefore, only support race-neutral universal programs. I mean, if I think if targeted programs are called for, then targeted programs are called for. But I think it makes a lot of sense to emphasize questions of economic inequality. And one nice thing that has occurred recently is the questions of economic inequality are back on the public agenda as a result of the Occupy movement, which I think was a very welcome development.
We're talking this morning, this part of Focus, with Tommy Shelby. He's professor of African American Studies and Philosophy at Harvard. He's visiting our campus to give a talk this afternoon. This is the annual philosophy lecture. I'll tell you a little bit more about that again and as we move into the second half of the show. First, though, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
WILO programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents Justice, Self-Respect, and the Culture of Poverty, with Tommy Shelby on Friday, March 30th at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. More information is available at the Center for Advanced Study website.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. Always welcome your questions and comments. In the second hour today, the guest is Charles Duhigg. He is an award-winning investigative reporter with the New York Times. We'll talk about his recent book, The Power of Habit. And it's all about the habit and the role that it plays in our lives, how much of what we do is habit, and about how habits are formed and how it is possible to change them. Next week on Monday, our guest will be Lucy Morgan Edwards. She's a former political advisor to the EU ambassador in Kabul, Afghanistan, and is a writer. And we'll talk about a book that she's written that's titled The Afghan Solution, the inside story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and how Western hubris lost Afghanistan. And this is a book in which she really makes the argument that if the problems of Afghanistan will be solved, it can't be a military solution. It has to be a political solution, and it has to be a solution that comes from within Afghanistan. She'll be joining us by telephone from London, I believe, or from Great Britain next week on the show. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can also find us on Facebook. This morning in this hour of Focus, Tommy Shelby is our guest. He's professor of African American Studies and Philosophy at Harvard. He's visiting the campus to give a talk this afternoon at 4. This is in the Millicom series. It's the annual philosophy lecture, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. 333-9455 is the number that you want to use to call if you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. I continue to think about how difficult it is to talk about these things, whether it's class or race, and think about how, for example, if you talk about the need for economic justice, then there were people who will say, oh, well, you're just trying to stir up class warfare. If you talk about something like, for example, as the president was asked recently about his thoughts about the Trayvon Martin case, the boy who was killed in Florida. And the president said he was obviously very touched by this. And he said, well, if I had a son, he would probably look like Trayvon. And people were all over him and said, oh, I can't believe you're bringing race into this. Why is it that we can't even talk about this, these kinds of things?
No, I agree. I wish I understood why race is such an emotionally hot topic. In some ways, unlike really any other in America, as soon as it gets invoked, blood pressure goes up, and people begin to get angry and defensive. And I wish I understood better. I mean, I try as a philosopher, as a teacher, to try to talk, you know, calmly and openly about these issues. Try my best to shed more light than heat on these matters. But even so, it can be difficult. They seem to touch people in a very visceral way. And we know, I mean, that whenever issues of criminal justice or the relationship between blacks and the criminal justice system arise, that emotions tend to run high. Mm-hmm. And there's a long history behind that. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about, obviously, our caller was very passionate about what we're talking about. I'm sure that a lot of people are. Do you get angry? Can you always be a philosopher and always be dispassionate? Or are there times that you really just get angry and you'd like to use words like we couldn't use here?
Oh, sure, and I do. use words we wouldn't use here at times. I mean, it's appropriate to have indignation and anger when you see injustice occur. And it's appropriate to be angry when you see people attempting to downplay the significance of a serious injustice, or to rationalize it away, or to put those who are trying to push for social justice on the defensive. And I think it's appropriate to react that way. But I think we also have to find ways to channel that anger and perhaps even resentment in productive ways. And we can't really make any progress on these questions unless we're able to do that, at least to some extent. And we haven't done so well on this score. Yeah. But I like to think that at least it's at least possible to have those kinds of discussions if people come to it in good faith. I mean, a lot of it, frankly, is that people are not coming to it in good faith. Mm-hmm. So I don't, sometimes when I see people reacting in what I regard as reactionary ways on questions of race, I think their motives are suspect. They're not seriously engaged with these questions. There are other things that they're concerned about, other agendas that are trying to advance. And this is just a wedge issue or a way to divide people and cast aspersions on other people's motives. Rather than trying to deal in a good faith way with these problems that we all should be invested in.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with them in Bourbonnais, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if the Native American Indians have any place in the civil rights movement.
Sure. I mean, there's a way in which the case of Native Americans is a rather complicated case because...
I rarely ever hear of them being mentioned in any talks that are discussed about civil rights, and they seem to be completely ignored in our America today.
I think that's fair and something to lament. I mean, the situation of Native Americans is rather complicated. I'm not an expert by any means. It's very complicated by the fact that many Native American nations have some autonomy over their internal affairs in the Native nations. So their status is somewhat different, say, from the status of Black Americans and who don't have any such claims of self-determination over their affairs. So it's a slightly more complicated thing to talk about what it means to be a member of U.S. society, a full citizen, and also a member of one of several Native American nations that have some self-determination. So part of it, I think, is that, and part of it is are the numbers. It's just Native Americans is a very, very small percentage of the population and tend not to get very much attention in the public sphere or in the media. And so people have very little knowledge of what's going on with them, except in the locations where there's some concentration.
Well, there's special days for almost everything in this country, but there's no special day for Native American observance. We have Black History Month. We have Black History Day or a day commemorating blacks. But Native American Indians seem to be completely ignored and lost in the train of thought. And pardon me. There seem to be no way that they can get into the mainstream of this country.
Well, I would entirely agree with you that it's a shame that most Americans probably have very little knowledge of Native American peoples, that we have not done nearly enough to acknowledge the history of Native American peoples and their role in the society and our role in, you know, marginalizing and disadvantaging those communities. So I would have no disagreement with you that we should be doing much better than we are on this question.
Do you think there's any place for a Native American History Month?
Sure. I think it would be a great thing. I mean, it would be a way of creating a space for public discussion and lectures and special media attention and shows that would raise consciousness about the situation of Native Americans in this country, and allow people to think a little bit about, and Americans don't like think that much about history in general, but I mean to think a little bit about the founding of their country and their relationship to the indigenous populations, you know, in North America, I think it would be a wonderful thing.
Well, I appreciate your comment.
All right, well, thanks for...
always been interested in the Native American situation in this country, and it seems to be very much ignored.
All right, well, thanks for the comment. Thanks for the thoughts. Others are certainly welcome to call and join us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, or you can send us an email, will-talk, at illinois.edu. I mentioned here a couple of times that you are a professor of philosophy and that you are here for the annual philosophy lecture. And I think that just as we were chatting before the program, I said I would think maybe some people would, when I tried to introduce the subject of what it was we were going to be talking about, some people might say, well, I would be natural that you would be talking with a political scientist about this or a sociologist about issues of race in America and so forth. But a philosopher, they might say, well, no, that's interesting, or maybe that's surprising. I guess my question would be, what does philosophy bring, or what can philosophy bring to a conversation about public policy, or for that matter, social justice and what we mean by that, and then where we get to where we want to be if we don't think we're there right now.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, philosophers have been thinking about what justice requires for a very, very long time. There's a long tradition, and just taking Western philosophy, there's a long tradition dating back to Plato's Republic, some 2,500 years ago, where people were thinking about, what would a just society look like? And that discussion continues through many of the great philosophers. And in the 20th century, one philosopher I'm particularly influenced by is John Rawls, who wrote a very famous book, A Theory of Justice, and wrote that in a way against the background of the civil rights movement, because it was published in 1971, having seen that and also having seen the struggle over Vietnam. And so it was written very much in the context of those sorts of questions. And he presented a sort of systematic theory of what justice requires, but also presented a model for thinking about these questions, a way of approaching these questions. And I like to think that that's the place where I think philosophers are most likely to be helpful about these questions. I mean, when we think about public policy, I mean, often the way people approach it is, identification of a problem. There's research about the causes of the problem. And then there are proposals for how to solve it. And I think philosophers, I think their place in these discussions is between the point of the research and the proposal, because any proposal that you make is going to be made on the basis of assumptions about certain values, about what's important, and indeed about what is just, even if those assumptions are merely implicit and never made explicit. And I think philosophers have a role to play in highlighting some of the underlying moral assumptions that go into a particular policy proposal, and philosophers can press for reflection on those proposals. Take a concrete example. So suppose you thought, as many people do, that part of the reason why there's so much concentrated disadvantage in urban communities is because of joblessness, that there are people who are not just unemployed, but many of them are not taking the jobs that they could get. So some policy people might see that, and they say, well, if we can just get low-skilled, especially low-skilled young men to accept these jobs, we could solve the problem. So we can institute a set of policies that will effectively either incentivize work or maybe even compel work in order to bring them out of poverty. So a philosopher might step between, the thought that, well, joblessness is the problem, and pushing people to work is the solution, to ask questions about work and about what's the place of work in a just society. Do people have an obligation to work? If they do have an obligation to work, what kind of obligation is it? What kinds of support should people get as they attempt to contribute to society through work? What constitutes an appropriate contribution? Are the only kinds of contributions of work ones that are that the market will compensate? What about unpaid work that's happening in that the many women have done for generations in the home and taking care of the house and taking care of children? So philosophers, I think, are good at thinking about those sorts of questions that are usually just sort of pushed into the background and not really reflected upon. And so those are the places where as a philosopher, I tend to make my interventions. Mm.
I think it's I like to think about, well, what would happen if we would go out on the street and we would start stopping people and ask them, well, what do you know about philosophy? What do you think philosophers do? I imagine that most people think that it's kind of a mysterious business, and it is about mysticism. And as I think about it, it's really more about process, in the sense that what I think, at least some philosophers, what they try to do is to help us think about thinking and how one approaches a particular problem and tries to take it apart and understand it and have some clarity of thought. And then perhaps if it is a problem that you're talking about, think about or talk about how what do you do about that? And I'm not sure that there's at the same time within our society today a whole lot of respect for that level of rationality. It seems that we're almost really suspicious of that, or at least somehow we don't honor careful rational thought. I'm not sure why that is, but I think that is. What do you think that is?
I don't know how to diagnose it exactly. I mean, you could say that it's in a way it's a part of our as Americans' cultural heritage, in a way, to be somewhat suspicious of a perceived intellectual elite, and to the extent that philosophy is understood in those terms, then people will naturally be skeptical of it. But I like to emphasize that we all sort of do a bit of philosophy, in our personal lives. We think about the classic questions, from questions about justice and love, and the meaning of life and death, existence of God, many questions that we're all sort of wrestling with, the philosophers have wrestled with over the centuries. And I think that what philosophers do, especially professional ones, is try to think, more systematically about these questions. Mm-hmm. They spend much more time reflecting on them. It's our job, after all. but we're engaged in the same kind of activity that I think people who are not professionals or who don't even know anything about philosophy don't even know that they're doing philosophy when they're engaged in these kinds of discussions or modes of reflection about the very, very basic questions about human existence. So in a way, I'd like to not try to separate the philosophical enterprise too sharply from everyday reflection, but just to emphasize that that philosophers might, just because they're spending much more time on it and reflecting on it in a very systematic way, and against a background of previous attempts to think systematically and in a deep way about it, they might have somewhat more insight about some of these questions, but they're just the basic questions of human life.
Hmm. We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them both. Muhammad is next in line. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask what the gentleman has to say about character. Martin Luther King talked about the content of our character. We never talk about character. What does he have to say? What does black leadership have to say about the content of character in the black community?
Well, the phrase in that part of the speech that people often mention from King was partly trying to articulate an ideal of our interpersonal relations, an ideal where we don't prejudge someone just on the basis of how they look or how they speak or how they're dressed and so on, but that we make our assessments about how we're going to interact here again in an interpersonal way with others on the basis of the quality of the character of the person. But I think sometimes people think that is an expression of how the state ought to interact with citizens, and I think that would be a distortion of the idea. It's not that I don't think on King's view, the role of the state to decide what kind of treatment it's going to give its citizens on the basis of judgments about the character of those citizens. There's a impartial and fair treatment is warranted, and the state should provide it, regardless of judgments about the character of those citizens. But obviously, the character of individuals matters enormously in our interpersonal relations with each other.
Well, I don't ever hear any discussion by black leaders about character. They talk a lot about the color of the skin. They talk a lot about racism. They never talk about character.
well, with all due respect, I would say that there's a much discussion about character. Those discussions tend to happen in churches, in community organizations, in discussions in informal discussions within communities. They happen in publications and online, where the discussions happen all the time. It just may you just may not be privy to some of those discussions.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have one person we can't take. Unfortunately, we're just almost out of time. Is there some reason, though, why that conversation is difficult to have as a public conversation?
I think it is difficult because I believe that some people think that the state ought to treat people differently if they're whether they have a good character or bad character. So take the case of Trayvon Martin. I think that some people present the case as, this is just a good kid. He's just got iced tea and Skittles, and he's up to no wrong. But I would insist that it's not appropriate. It wouldn't be appropriate to profile him, hunt him down, and kill him, even if he had a bad character, even if he had attitudes that many of us would regard as seriously problematic. It wouldn't justify treating him poorly or taking treating his life as if it were less significant than the life of a white person. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people some blacks might be resistant to emphasizing questions of character in that way in general public discourse, because they realize that people will use that as a justification for regarding people, especially black people, as do less than what they in fact do.
With my apologies, there's so much more we could do. We'll have to stop. Our guest, Tommy Shelby, is professor of African American Studies and Philosophy at Harvard. He'll talk this afternoon on the U of I campus at 4. This is an event in the MillerCom series. It's the annual philosophy lecture. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.